previously on Wisco Weekly.
You know, it's complicated, isn't it? And when you talk about investments in high-speed rail and things like Hyperloop, we're talking about billions of dollars, and we all know that. And, you know, the interesting part about dedicating a system for just autonomous vehicles is how much throughput you can actually get in that system. So here are the things that I would suggest if you are actually going to promote something like that. When you think about a throughput, and actually a company that was right there in LA, Arrivo, which unfortunately just closed its doors, had sort of an interesting hybrid between Hyperloop technologies on sleds that were in a lane that had the capacity of moving at up to 200 miles an hour, so it would take the vehicles through. So the risks and challenges that you run with sort of the speed and the travel. So I'll tell you the risks. Autonomous vehicle lane. You can start platooning the vehicles, you can start running them 6 inches off of each other's bumper and keep them running. Right now, a traditional lane can get 2,000 vehicles through an hour. That's with human drivers. So let's assume that you could double that. So 4,000 cars, let's say, through on an autonomous driving system that's platooned, and it creates utter efficiency in how the vehicles move. And then those vehicles are moving all of the time. So therein lies the trick. Is it single occupant in those cars? Or is it multiple occupants in those cars? Because you're still in a state and still in an environment where you're having a lot of people and a lot of people who need to move. So the one value on the train side, if you will, or the is the mass part of transit, is the mass movement of people.
And on this episode,
you're in the automobile business. I mean, they're the masters at being able to do an effective job of being able to find something that the customer is looking for and see how that benefits them and enhances their lot.
This is Wisco Weekly, an automotive business podcast sharing the voices of automakers, automotive retailers, and transportation professionals who are driving and shaping the future of automotive.
You are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Chicken brown, cow.
Listeners, welcome to another episode of Wisco Weekly. I'm so blessed right now as I sit in the offices or in the conference room of my guest in Newport Beach, California. And I will put up pictures on the episode page of his office. But, you know, on a previous episode, myself and Rudy Solo, we had talked about one of the benefits of podcasts and specifically how it is the future of in-car entertainment. And one of the reasons we agreed between myself, Rudy Solo, and then our guest, Maddie Stout, at that time, who is the VP of podcast programming for iHeartRadio, was that you have all these different voices who now get to come to the forefront and talk about some of the things that they either do that they've been an expert on or something that they have deep, intensive knowledge with. And that certainly applies today. Today's guest has been labeled a visionary, be it a power plant in the high desert of California or installing telephone lines in the Congo in Africa, to a contentious high-speed rail in Nevada, or using cow manure to produce electricity. My guest brings more than 30 years of grit and tenacity in completing power plants and utility services. He is a 1964 graduate of University of Arkansas, having obtained his bachelor's in science in industrial engineering. Fast forward 13 years after his graduation, and he was inducted into the Engineering Hall of Fame as its youngest member. In addition to being a visionary, my guest has also been described as a bulldog in sheep's clothing and an Eagle Scout. Currently, he serves as the president of Inland Energy, a company focused on development activities for real estate, infrastructure, and energy-related projects. Here to share greater insight into the Las Vegas high-speed rail, men, women, and children, please welcome to the show a proud fighting Razorback, Mr. Buck Johns.
Honored to be here.
Mr. Johns, thank you, sir, for being here. I sincerely appreciate it. I sincerely appreciate you welcoming me into your humble abode here. You know, I guess before we get started here, you know, I've you've been kind of associated with some animals here, a bulldog in sheep's clothing, a razorback, an Eagle Scout. And yet when I do come to your office, I do see lots of animal type themes around here. Is there some kind of connection, some like spiritual connection you have to animals?
No, I've always enjoyed the West. I've enjoyed the cowboys and Indians, and I grew up in a small town in Arkansas, and we were over in Oklahoma and got exposed to that. So I've loved Western art all my life.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's impressive here, especially again when you come to, Newport Beach. You would think that you're just going into perhaps, the office itself is just going to be luxurious, but you've definitely customized it and have put your little spin on it. So it's recognized on my part. I'm sure you get lots of compliments. And again, listeners, I'll throw some pictures up on the episode page so you can see this for yourself. So, Buck, we have a lot of things to get into today. And I thought one of the things that I would ask initially is, having you on the show, you're going to have some intimate knowledge of the Las Vegas high-speed rail, and certainly it's not like you're part of the mainstream media speaking tour, but yet you can argue that you have affected a lot of different projects, social projects. You've had your influences through the political structure. So I thought that one of the things, as a way to give listeners context of who you are, perhaps you can describe some of the projects you've been involved with that have been most meaningful to you.
Well, first and foremost, when you're in the entrepreneurial game, if you're going to be successful, you got to be involved in politics. And I've been involved in politics since I was a little guy, all the way through college. And then after I got out, some people go bowling and I go to fundraisers. So I've made a lot of friends in the political world. And what I've used is, when you're in the political game, you're always trying to get something that's difficult to obtain through the political sphere. And those are the kind of projects that I've gravitated towards. I've added that dimension to the project with which I've been involved. The power plant that you see a picture of on the wall here is the first combined cycle power plant. It uses jet engines to burn the natural gas to produce the electrons. And that to get a permit to build a power plant is complicated. The Public Utilities Commission in California is a very difficult undertaking. Can't build them in the basin because of the emissions problem. So I brought that dimension to the concept of being able to get the political will through Sacramento, through the Department of Energy in D.C., and through the locals, in this case, in Victorville. The question that came up back in 1986 when I was looking at the high-speed train, George Duke Majan was the governor, and I was deep into his campaign when he got elected, and I went to speak with the governor, and they had just formed the Bi-State Superspeed Train Commission, and that was to bring a high-speed train between Anaheim, which was excited about that. Don Roth was the mayor of Anaheim, and he was excited, and the people in Las Vegas, they formed a commission. And I became a consultant to that commission. And I was a part of the effort to try to get the right-of-way that would go between Anaheim and Las Vegas.
And so that's 1986. And so, I guess this starts to now take us in a little bit more into, not exactly present times, but maybe 10 years ago, when there was a little bit more of a formal structure in terms of specifically Desert Express, and now building a station in Victorville that would connect to Las Vegas. So maybe connect the dots for me from Anaheim and how that all of a sudden the talks evolved to putting a station to Victorville now.
I went to the city of Yorba Linda. There's a trains go through Yorba Linda. If you go down the 91 freeway and look on the north side of the freeway, you'll see a lot of tracks through there. And I had friends there because I was on the board of directors of the Nixon Library. And so I met with the locals there. And they went apoplectic about the concept of putting a 200-mile-an-hour train going through Yorba Linda. And it didn't take us long to figure out that's going to be a very heavy lift. So we went back and started having our conversations with our partners over in Vegas, and that it's going to be difficult to be able to get the political approvals for doing that. BNSF and Union Pacific were not enthused about this. We wanted to run new tracks, dedicated trains, and that the Bi-State Superspeed Train Commission had retained the Bechtel Corporation as its consultant. So we were hoping to put in a magnetic levitation train that would be going 300 miles an hour. Yorblinda didn't want that.
Yeah, I guess, so let's go back to that point in time, because I'm curious to know if some of the objections that were going on back in the late 80s were of, you know, perhaps some of the objections over the last few years when, for instance, we had voted on getting a California high-speed rail and that fell apart. So what were some of the objections that some of these cities were saying on the reason why they did not want the train to start in Anaheim?
Well, we were private. We still are private. And the discussion that you're having right now about the, which will be the Virgin train, is the new name of it, which has evolved, is all private funds. We're not talking about the Jerry Brown $100 billion train to, that's not it. Mm-hmm. This is a private, so the consideration for the capital is a big consideration to be able to get something in and operating, and that will have to go to the markets, to the capital markets to be able to raise the capital, but it would all be private funds. The biggest single problem that we had were the numbers of cities that were ardently opposed. And then when you go through the Cajon Pass, you have more problems there. As you go through there, get to Ontario and head on up the Cajon Pass. Because of the sheer size of the capital raise there, we ran an analysis on an economic concept of, in essence, moving Vegas to Victorville so we could go and communicate to people that want to go to Vegas, and they see how long it takes to get there, and particularly on the weekends, it can take an 8-hour drive. So the concern there was, why don't we just have a big terminal there in Victorville, and then you can get on a speed train from Victorville and go the 200 miles to Vegas. And so that concept, when we ran it through the marketing studies, brought the cost of what we were doing down from in the $15 billion range with the grade separations and all of these things. And so we were down a much more manageable number at less than half that. So the concept...
And is that by today's dollars or...
In essence, today's dollars.
Okay.
So the concept then was to put the a terminus there, and you drive there, have a big parking lot, check your luggage. It's checked all the way into your room, and then you can take your shoes off and none of that goofy TSA search that you go through on airplanes. The whole thing worked, and so we went did our market studies, and that works.
So initially then, the name that the train was going to be called was Desert Express, and that was, again, dating back to the late 80s, and sometime, 2006-ish, there was an acquisition of Desert Express by Express West. They did something, they furthered the project, and then most recently, as I had read, I think back in September of 2018, Brightline, who is also owned by Virgin and Richard Branson's group, they acquired Express West. Is that correct?
That's pretty close. The key guy that came in to put the money up, because we were trying to get the permit through the federal government, would be the ones that would give us the permit for the transportation, and that we wanted to run it down the middle of the 15 freeway. So we had to go to Washington. We had to get the Department of Transportation involved, the Federal Railroad Authority, all of those people had to come together, and it was a complicated and took years, and that we were successful at doing that. The guy that put up the capital necessary to jump through all those hoops was a man by the name of Tony Marnell. And Marnell Industries is a big developer. He's done a lot of the hotels in Vegas and stuff. He's an architectural graduate of USC, and his son, Tony III, is involved in all of this. And that he was the one that acquired it and funded all those costs to be able to get it. And today we have the permit to go down the center of the 15 freeway.
And so, okay, so let's talk about the geographies now. So Victorville is where the first station, or well, is one of the starting or ending points, and then it goes all the way into Vegas. And where is the station in Vegas where this train would drop you off?
It is contemplated that the station in Vegas would be next to the Rio, right next to the freeway, downtown the Rio, and then the monorail would come across the freeway and pick up, so everything is coordinated through that terminus that would be right next to the Rio.
One of the things about Victorville, and again, I'm going to just play on stereotypes here, but obviously you have had a good number of dealings in that city, but the high desert hasn't always been exactly favorable to people in LA or Orange County in terms of wanting to stop in Victorville, for instance, and hang out. Drug problems have plagued that area. What is it about Victorville on why that was chosen to be the station?
Now, Dennis, I'd take a little umbrage at the drug problem there. South Central's got drug problems, but Victorville doesn't have drug problems. And that they're pro-business, they're pro-growth, they're receptive to being able to do things. It's a job-generating mecca, and the central focus up there is the Southern California Logistics Airport. That was the former George Air Force Base, and that it was a redevelopment area until Jerry Brown and the guys killed redevelopment. But there is a lot of economic growth there, and they're receptive to doing these kinds of things. You can develop a large activity there, plenty of land to do it, and they're receptive, and you're not in the South Coast Air Quality Management District. You're in the...
Wait, can you explain that some more? The South Coast Air Quality District?
Yeah, South Coast Air Quality Management District restricts the amount of emissions that can come from any activity in here. Half the emissions come from transportation-related issues, the ports and the trucks that supply the ports, the transportation. In order to get the right to emit, to put more carbon in the air down here, you have to acquire that from somebody else. And that we tried to put a power plant down here because this is where the power demand is, but we couldn't do it. So we did it up there. And the emissions problems that would plague anybody trying to do something like this down here do not exist up there. So we need to develop the activities up there, and they're receptive to doing it, and that there are good freeways that access Victorville up to Palmdale and come across and then come up through the 15 through the Cajon Pass. So it's a good collecting point. Now, once it's in and operating for a relatively short period of time, the cost then to bring it down through the Cajon Pass will be the next step, bringing it down here, and the same thing to go over to Palmdale.
So one of the things, it's been touted on some different websites, and I guess the first thing that I saw was on expresswest.com, was that the train would take, or the frequency of the train would be every 20 minutes.
It's private enterprise. It'll be whatever the demand is. If the demand justifies that, then you do it.
And God,
if the train needs to be longer to be able to carry more people, that it'll be longer.
So then speed then. So speed seems to be topping out at 150, which there are some arguments that say that 150 for this kind of train is relatively slow. How does that, doesn't that contradict then the ability for any kind of private enterprise to say, hey, you know what, no problem, we'll take it up to 200, we'll take it up to 300?
And we should. And that the federal government regulates the speed of trains in the USA, and the upper limit's 150.
So then some interesting stats here. So again, there's 17 million visitors that would travel between Las Vegas and Southern California. At any given weekend on the I-15, there are 3,000 vehicles per hour, and with more than 80% of traffic heading to some kind of hotel or casino in Vegas. And so the solution here for this high-speed train is that it would accommodate approximately 20 million travelers between here and Las Vegas. Now, based on everything, when and I think these were stats of perhaps maybe 10 years ago, but Do you know, is this what at least the initial setup of the train is going to adhere to?
We did the market analysis, and that keep in mind, some people are going to fly. That's a given. And that some people are going to drive. But some people are looking for a better answer, and that and we were excited to see the development of Uber. So that adds another answer. The monorail that exists in Vegas that connects the casinos, all of those things are positives as far as we're concerned. Mm-hmm. And we think that there will be sufficient numbers to be able to justify the cost of being able to build and operate and maintain this facility. We're going to high-speed rail. Every country in the world, every first world country, has a high-speed rail system, and the Chinese showed us how to make this thing work.
Can you elaborate more on that?
China has the largest high-speed rail system in the world, bigger than all the rest of the world combined. And so we spent quite a bit of time with the Chinese engineers looking at this. They came over. They drove the right-of-way. There was had a busload of the people from China that were part of their Department of Transportation over there, and they figured out how to do this. And the sophistication of your listeners that have ridden a high-speed train, the TGV in France, the bullet train in Japan, and the trains in China, they're all the same. They're all steel wheel, steel rail, and they all run at 300 kilometers, which is 186 miles an hour. They're now moving those up because their sophistication, they've learned how to make them operate, catch the numbers of passengers and stuff. So now then they're running. And we should mention that we talked about, because this comes up in conversation, about magnetic levitation, and that's another consideration. It's a propulsion system, but it's complicated, and it's very difficult to make work on an economic basis.
Let's do just a quick dive, elementary level, if you will, on magnetic levitation. So explain that concept a little bit more and how that compares to rails.
The Germans came out. Magnetic levitation was invented in the U.S. The Germans then were fascinated with magnetic levitation. It goes all the way back to Second World War. And they did some sophisticated things. And that the best description that I have heard, and this was given to me when my wife Colleen and I went over to Bremen, Germany, and rode the Transrapid demonstration magnetic levitation track. They have a train runs on an 18-mile loop over there. It's as if you take an electric motor and you cut it in two, and you take the stator and you open it up, and it becomes the track, and the rotor becomes the train. You plug it in, and it goes like a rocket. And you can go as fast as you want to because there's no contact between it's magnetically levitated, means there's magnets in here, opposing magnets, mm-hmm. and they sit apart, and you can go as fast as you want to. And the commercial application, interestingly, that has been wonderfully successful with magnetic levitation is the launching of our fighter aircraft off of aircraft carriers. They're all launched, no longer with steam. It's all magnetic levitation, mm-hmm. and that it can shoot those aircraft off the end of it with much greater force, and they've got those great big nuclear power plants, so the power that they need is there to project those.
And so is the one of the reasons why magnetic levitation is currently off the table for the Las Vegas high-speed rail because, as you had mentioned earlier, above 150, federal government starts to regulate that, and then is that just more hurdles to overcome at that point in terms of deploying magnetic levitation?
Not quite. The reason for the absence of we're going to change that 150. It's just a matter of getting. Trump would do it in a second if he gets his people in his office and in proper offices and that kind of stuff. They'll fix that. The state of our train systems right now need to be upgraded. The freight boys, BNSF and Union Pacific, would do that. The Acela is the only high speed, and it runs just over 100 miles an hour on the East Coast. That's the only, that we call that. The reason for the magnetic levitation upper limits is that we've learned it's a mechanical nightmare. The Chinese were the first ones on it and built the demonstration track from the airport in Shanghai almost to downtown, and it operates today. It's fascinating to see it, and you can go up 400 kilometers on that train in a short period of time, and it's captivating. But the problem that we have is if you've got an electric motor and you've got all of that and the sand blows through it, you got problems. Mm. It's just a mechanical nightmare.
Oh, so you don't need a full enclosure for that car or, you know, for that train to conduct this magnetic levitation. I'm thinking like it has to be in a tube more or less.
No.
No, you don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's the eventual talks of bringing the high-speed rail from Victorville and connecting it with Los Angeles somehow, some way.
Yeah. The first connection will be running it from Victorville to Palmdale. When you get to Palmdale, you're in the train system. That's the public transportation train system. There's a terminal in Palmdale. So now you're connected up there, and it'd be low speed there. But as this thing develops, then those rights of way can be utilized for faster trains. And that would be the next step, is to straighten out those right of way so that you can be able to have high-speed train. The shorter distance would be to come through the Cajon Pass. And that's where there are three tracks going through the Cajon Pass today. And that it's the busiest rail corridor in America is that Cajon Pass. And if you go through there anytime, night or day, there's a 100-car train going, and there's one right behind it. Just keeps going through. 40% of the imported goods to the U.S. come through the ports of Long Beach and L.A. And so all of those goods are disseminated all the way across the U.S., and they go through almost all of those goods. Some are distributed here because, you know, we're 40 million population in California, but so we consume a portion. But when you see the stuff that's coming into those ports down there, they're loaded on trains, and there you go down at downtown at that big train station downtown, and they go through the Cajon Pass, and they're distributed all across the country.
So what is preventing the build-out now, then, to connect downtown L.A.'s metro station to Victorville?
There is efforts in there, but there's no demand for that traffic today. Just they used to have trains that ran to Vegas, but they don't anymore.
There's no demand. I mean, in my head, I would think there's demand, especially in this day and age where you have a lot of, you have this kind of uprising of transportation systems that are trying to be more highly encouraged. Is you're saying that there's no demand? Is that at like a recent study, or is that like where is that based off of?
Well, it's an economic question. Is the amount of time that it takes to ride on Amtrak to get to Vegas? And that it takes forever. It's a slow moving, it's not the kind of experience that people are ready for or are willing to participate in when you've got these other, the freeways slowed down all of that.
Right, right.
That kind of development.
So in terms of your company, Inland Energy,
mm-hmm.
what role do you guys have within the Las Vegas high-speed rail project?
Well, we were involved early on, and that 33 years ago when we put up these relief maps and stuff, and we're working with the governor on this project. And then the guy that really took it and advanced the ball was Marnell from Vegas, mm-hmm, and he mm-hmm. really did a crackerjack job. And he is the one that now has joined with Brightline. And Brightline has partnered with Virgin Transportation to change their labeling of their system, and that this is a part of that. Tony will be on the board of directors of that entity.
Okay. Now, is it a foregone conclusion, then, that this Las Vegas high-speed rail, it is going to happen?
Nothing happens until a first spade is turned, until you sell the ticket and you climb on it. But I'm convinced there is going to be something. I think this is the best option that's been put together. And that, as you know, there was a public offering that went out and was pulled back because they found that they did have significant interest from private investors in it, and that the private investors were doubly interested in it because there's going to be high-speed rail in this country, and the permit for being able to build this one is already in place.
You know, as these rails are being developed and these transportation systems are being developed, are there any technologies that are being implemented in these new modern rail systems? meaning that, you know, are there additional sensors established? Are there some of these, you know, satellite towers that will be laid out throughout the course between Victorville and Las Vegas that, forget, you know, having Wi-Fi access, but something that would, you know, really enhance not just the experience, but, you know, perhaps even safety, knowing the fact that, hey, you know, at it looks like at this point in the rail, one of the sensors went off in the rail that it, we need to fix this. Are there any of those types of technologies that are being implemented, or are there any such things like that that exist?
Europe has done a lot of work in that area to making these things safer because of the prevalence of train travel. And the Chinese have done a hell of a job there as well, because now they're the biggest. They're the biggest in terms of this activity. But all of those features, the biggest single thing that I have observed is the suspension system. The suspension systems are better. The tracks are straighter. The comfort level of riding, and you can balance a nickel on the table in any of these trains right now, and it'll stay balanced. And the propulsion system that we're using now are all electric trains, and there's a catenary, like the old streetcars where you pull the current off of the wires that are and cables that are above. It's the same concept. So you've got electric motors that are driving the thing, and they're pulling electricity from somewhere, and they got to be plugged in. Well, they're plugged into that catenary that's over the top of them.
Will this be an electric-powered train?
Totally.
Fully?
Fully.
Oh, I thought it would still be a hybrid.
No.
No. Oh, wow.
No.
And so is that where perhaps part of your High Desert project falls into this at all?
I sure hope so.
Okay, I want to do a little bit of a pivot here. And that is because you have been involved with a lot of, you know, with a lot of different projects that do that does take this political will. I wanted to maybe kind of dive into some of the politics of this a little bit. So, you know, when, for instance, when you were first setting up and you guys were first talking about setting up this project, this high-speed rail project that was starting in Anaheim. Obviously you met some challenges along the way. You've had to adjust, and now it's in Victorville. But some of that political will that you had to overcome, you know, maybe tell me a little bit about what is it like dealing with all the political powers that be and trying to make everybody happy, make everyone's voices heard?
It's the concept have to make sense. And when we've been involved in projects, and as much as I like fooling with a city council to get a permit to build a house and stuff, these are a little more complicated. And you're dealing with Washington, and I've been active in Washington. I love going there. My wife's an artist, and we enjoy the museums and we've been connected up there. We've been connected in Sacramento. We've been blessed to a lot of this stuff by having Republican governors and Duke Majan and Pete Wilson that were open to doing these kind of creative things. And that the local municipalities where we are, with the redevelopment aspect, they were able to get tax increment off of these investments. That's where Jerry Brown was wrong. In eliminating that, it reduces the incentives for municipalities to be able to work with you to bring these huge assets in there. Our power plant's over almost $700 million. There was tax increment that came off there of $60 million that could be captured and paid off by the taxes there, and they could put in infrastructure to be able to attract more jobs, mm-hmm. and they did.
Is there any part of the high-speed rail, then, when you were first devising it, when you were with the first committee, that because of the game of politics that the project was watered down, essentially, to accommodate the players that be?
Well, we moved it from Anaheim to Victorville.
But even now that it is in Victorville, in terms of its initial concept and everything, is that kind of still in place? Or again, there was some modifications done to it where, okay, maybe, you know, we don't have, again, it was designed to be 200. Now we have to do 150 because we need to appease this political organization and so forth and so on?
Fair question. And the answer to that question is that's not a consideration, large consideration, because we know we can move that up when we've got the safety and all that kind of stuff. And it's the systems that are running at 300 over in China.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So so essentially, at least just to get it off the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, the other part, as we talk about politics, I mean, I recall that, we share a good friend, Ken Purcell.
Yep.
And, there was a time when I was working at UC Irvine in the athletic department, and the head coach at the time of the basketball team was Pat Douglas. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
I did. Yeah. Sure did. Played golf with him.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, you guys are probably scratch golfers here.
No.
Well, I remember having a conversation with Douglas, and he said something to me that it's always been burned in my memory now. And that is that, you know, Dennis, as you grow older, I think I was like maybe mid-20s at that time, he goes, as you get older, you're gonna have to understand the game of politics, and specifically office politics, you know. And after he actually told me that, I was watching him go around the different offices, talk to people, and I'm like, man, he's doing the political game here. So you obviously were doing that, but now on a much larger scale. You know, if I'm to ask you, well, Buck, what are the, you know, what would be some of the advice you would give to somebody who's trying to play this political game in order to get something passed? How do you advise somebody to go about it?
It's an interesting game. The politics transcends all the barriers. I came to California a long time ago, and because I was in the world of politics, and I'd go to fundraisers, and I'd go around and I'd meet people. And I got to know probably the most distinguished individual in Orange County who was largely inaccessible and was a very quiet guy, was named Arnold Beckman. And I had read about him, and Beckman instruments were in my engineering college and all that kind of stuff. One day I'm standing next to him at a fundraiser, and my God, that's Arnold Beckman. And so you get to meet people, and if you go to these kinds of things, I would encourage any young person to get involved. Volunteer. Go volunteer on campaigns. Get to know people. You never know. One of them could matriculate into bigger things. I was the financier for Ed Royce when he ran on a long shot deal for a state Senate seat. The last 8 years, he'd been chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, the top foreign affairs advisor in this country. And I still got all of his cell numbers, and I was in his wedding. So you see those kinds of things that grow and prosper. But it's another part of the education. You're in a capitalistic society. If you've got those kinds of connections and you're able to go be able to get an audience with those kinds of people, you can learn what are the problems, what are the barriers, what do I have to do, how do I get this thing to be much acceptable in order to make this thing fit. We've got the concept, how do we make it happen, and it's through the government.
Now, the other part, too, and this is where I have a little bit of background, but more on the solicitation end, and that is fundraising. Fundraising is another big part of politics where, again, in the context of a project like the Las Vegas High-Speed Rail, you know, you are perhaps having to bring in some of your friends and your contacts to leverage their capital to help support a project like this. One of the big topics that always gets that gets talked about often now is, you know, okay, now be it the high-speed rail or be it some existing transportation projects that are going on in Los Angeles or New York, maybe it's the bus transit system, maybe it's the subway. There still needs to be funding for infrastructure. Now, obviously, the key method of this of fundraising here is through taxes. But on the private fundraising end, you know, how would you advise someone like the mayor of Los Angeles who does need to go out and fundraise private dollars? How does he go about raising private funds?
I'm not a big government guy.
Right.
And that anytime they start digging the big dig in Boston and stuff that ran $20 billion over on the cost and stuff, anytime the government gets involved in something, they do it as probably as poorly as anybody could. It's a better method, in my mind, for trying to have private individuals, private structures, private companies and stuff undertake. And that's what's happening across the globe. More and more people are getting involved in these private undertakings. And the Chinese have done a lot of this where they have government-owned entities. Well, what they've done is they brought the private sector in there, so there's a private incentive and stuff to undertake it. But they're not straight government activities, which is what Jerry Brown was trying to do when he was trying to build that
high-speed rail to
San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So any of those things are, it needs to be able to stand the test of the capital markets. And if you can get somebody to commit their dollars to give to you to build it so they can get a revenue stream from the project that's constructed, they'll look at all aspects, and the likelihood of it going sour is pretty close to non-existent.
I forgot what I was going to ask you here about that fundraising.
Well, let me comment something while you're thinking about that.
Okay.
Is that the big thing that the government has, it has the ability to help, and it can give you the permit, and it's got eminent domain. And eminent domain is where you take away from somebody their property. And that's a very difficult undertaking, but if you compensate the person whose property is taken away in a manner such that they're happy to sell it, happy to give it, happy to make a transaction, or become a part of your venture. And that's where we got involved in the activities up in Victorville, as the local property owners. We brought them in as partners in the deal, and some of them said they didn't want to be partners, so we bought their properties.
It was, did that only happen in Victorville? Was there anywhere else along this?
Because we were in the federal right-of-way. When the Eisenhower built the freeway system, he had a big, wide right-of-way, and the right-of-way through the desert is massive, and so we could stay in that right-of-way.
Okay, so actually I do remember the question here, and that is, are you familiar with public-private partnerships?
Absolutely.
So it seems to me that public-private partnerships is, in my eyes, a great compromise of the ability for the private sector to get involved in some of these public projects. However, it also seems to be the case where you just don't have enough of the private companies that want to get into these public ventures. Is that an accurate statement?
It is an accurate statement, and it's got to make sense. Somebody's got to buy a ticket, and that then justifies all the rest of the activities that are taking place. So you can't get involved in these boondoggles, and you put private money in, you lose it. And so people with private funds, they're the best stewards of where those funds go. And
let's do kind of I don't want to say a debate per se, but give me an argument that would argue for P3s and an argument against P3s.
Sometimes it's the only way you can do it. You've got to have the public involved in order to make it work. When you're trying to go through rights of way and build highways, and it, you're going to need the public involved in that, because a private entity can't. He can get held up. The little old lady that's got the deal in this, and it's got the 2-acre deal, is holding up a 12-lane freeway. So you've got to have the public involved. And that was when Eisenhower did it with the freeway system, and when the railroads came in 100 years before that. And so you've got all of these considerations that are necessary to have. But in terms of efficiency and resources to be able to bring in and then manage the affairs, you got to have the private.
Is there something about either a state or local government that has P3 policies that you believe are absolutely detrimental to bringing in private dollars for these projects?
California.
And
California's terrible.
Is there something specific about California policies of P3s?
It's the abuses that you run into in California, and that you have the organizations that are in there that will extort you, and they will attack your project, attack your environmental impact report, attack that, and then they want money to go away, and then they'll insist on getting labor agreements that make the project prohibitively expensive, drive the costs up, slow the projects down. And so that's the kind of thing that you run into. You don't have that problem as much, a little bit, but in Texas. In certain cities are very much like that. And that I have to say that the high desert, they don't like those things. The city governments up there understand those things, and they'll work with you. We did the power plant. Every time that I went to Sacramento and met with the Energy Commission or met with elected officials up there, the mayor would go with me, and he would say, we're four square with this project. And that meant that I had the public part of the public-private partnership standing right there with us, pushing hard on the deal. And he got the big check when we did the redevelopment and issued the bonds. Mm-hmm. So he had a vested interest in the deal, and he was wonderfully helpful. It's the only project that the Power Plant, Power Magazine was talking about that they've ever seen where there was never opposition to a power plant.
And again, this is now coming full circle here, Buck, of your younger years of getting involved in politics and being able to navigate, you know, that culture to now all of a sudden when there is a project at stake, being able to leverage your relationships, being able to navigate those waters so that you can make a strong front to the governor of Sacramento or the governor of California in Sacramento to now all of a sudden pass these projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that helps.
Buck, just a couple more questions here then. So I guess I want to talk more about you now then. So how did you get to become this business leader you are now? Maybe share with me some either guiding mentors or books or your habits of how you've gotten to this place. Because with respect here, sir, with absolute respect, I think it'd be rude to ask how old you are.
77.
77. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I obviously wasn't rude at all. You're 77. You're still properly dressed in a white shirt and a tie, and you seem like you have at least another 30 years in you. So what is it that you have been doing to maintain this energy, this vigor about the work that you do?
Well, I think it's one of the you look at a number of different factors, and one of the factors is that you have to exercise, you have to take care of yourself. You have to work out every day, and not every other day. You have to work out every day. You don't take off on the weekends. You work out. It doesn't take long, but you have to do it to get the circulation. So that helps you to feel better. It gives you the best odds. And then you need to take care of yourself and get your physicals and that kind of stuff. And the next thing that I find is be engaged in interesting things. And that the next step behind that is be engaged with interesting people. So if you get interesting people around you, you're involved in interesting things, and you take care of yourself, you can have a hell of a lot of fun. And I have, and I still do.
And I mean, what are some upcoming either professional projects or personal projects that you're looking forward to? I mean, be it if it's the remainder of this year, maybe into next year?
Well, one of the divisions of my companies is that we're involved in investor visas. So foreigners can make an investment in this country and get a green card. Now, we're not for opening up the borders. I think having open borders is nuts. And that's not something that I'm in favor of. I'm over there with Trump on that issue. And that the activity here is that we go over there and we meet people. And that we meet people that are interested in making an investment. The finest education system, higher education system in the world is the USA. We're learning a whole lot about that I hadn't planned on of late, but that whole system is something that people in other countries are interested in. If they can make an investment here in this country and get a green card, their children can come over here and be educated. And my kid went to graduate school in England. It was a great experience for him. He came back bigger and bolder and more knowledgeable. And I think all of those things are a part of what we need to impart to our kids so they got that zest for learning and that zest for understanding. And I thoroughly enjoy travel. And I go to Asia on every other month.
For business and pleasure?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, primarily business.
Primarily business for the
Investor visa. It's called EB-5.
Yeah, EB-5. Mm-hmm. You were a long time, I mean, I guess in a lot of ways you're still a quote-unquote sales professional. I mean, I'm sure that's probably nature of the job.
Sure.
If you were to share some sales advice what would be some of the sales advice you would share?
Well, I think the deal is that people tend to think they don't have to get current or read the books. I was at grandson was on a hockey tournament up in San Jose week before last. Cupertino's right next door. So my wife and I went over to the visitor center of Apple, and they've got that circular. It's a mile around the damn thing. Mm-hmm. They can't get in there, but they've got a visitor center that's fascinating. And there's probably not a better salesman than Steve Jobs, and he's selling this stuff in there. And he's got that little tablet and the whole works. I took pictures of it. I videotaped it and the whole works. I was captivated by all of that. But you can learn from these people, and that there's a whole system of preparing yourself and trying to be able to tell a story and be able to communicate the concept. So lots of different ways to do it.
Okay, then last question then. So then from selling, then there's the negotiating aspects. So I'm sure you've had your wars in negotiating. What would be some of your best tips when it comes to negotiating?
It's got to be something, and that's the beauty of our system, the free enterprise system. It has to be worthwhile for both sides or it won't occur. Can't force that. So you've got to be able to understand what they're looking for and what do you have and what are you're looking for to help them meet their needs, and that make sure that it's beneficial for both sides. And so I think the empathy part of it is critical so that both parties come out. And that's why in 200 years we dominate the world, is that we don't have governments telling us who to sell stuff to or who to buy. You're in the automobile business. I mean, they're the masters at being able to do an effective job of being able to find something that the customer is looking for and see how that benefits them and enhances their lot.
And that's kind of exactly why I wanted to ask these questions, because there are a lot of automotive professionals who need to hear some of this stuff. So, well, Mr. Johns, thank you, sir.
It's been my honor, Dennis, and congratulations on this fascinating venture that you're doing. It's a brand new game for me, but it is just captivating.
Well, it great. And again, it's, you know, as I stated earlier on, it one of the benefits of what I love about doing my own podcast show is that I am meeting so many fantastic people who would not have otherwise been able to share their insight and their knowledge and their expertise out there, because again, they're not just part of the mainstream media circle. And so certainly as I was introduced to you, in my head, I'm like, this is exactly Buck Johns. I mean, I know that in your world that you're a big player, but in this other world that I dive into, unfortunately, nobody said Buck Johns. Nobody said Inland Energy. And so, as I looked into you and the company, I'm like, holy shit, need to have this guy on the show. So,
well, I'm honored to be a participant in the deal, and congratulations on your show. I think it's just fascinating.
Well, thank you, sir. We will be in touch more often. I'm certain I'll be following your progress, and maybe we'll have you on again. Maybe we'll have our good friend Ken Purcell on too.
That would be great. And if it all works out and we break ground, then we'll have to get back together and tell the story.
I would love that.
Yeah,
I would love that. Mm-hmm. And maybe not. You said if we break ground.
Well, I'm hoping. You know, we've got our hopes up. We've been at it 33 years.
Oh man, that's so long. Well, listeners, again, please be sure to visit the episode page. I'll put some of the pictures of his office and some. Buck, are you on social media at all? I didn't find anything, so I don't know if people could.
I've got a Facebook, but I don't have a Facebook page. Okay. I just do that to accommodate the kids.
Okay, so can't really follow Buck Johns. So unfortunately, the only way you really get to learn about him is through this episode. So. Be sure you share this episode then with your friends so that people can be more familiar with him and Inland Energy. On behalf of myself, Kelly, and Rudy, cheers, prost, l'chaim, kipis, nastravi, salu, kampai, mabruk, tutsins, gambe, yamas, to the customer experience.